So we are at the third portion of the Torah, the third week after Simchat Torah, when we finished reading the entire Torah and we start over again. And this week's reading is really the epic reading of the Torah because it introduces us to Abraham. And the way it introduces it to us is very puzzling. Let's take our books, page 53. Now, last week we talked about the beginning of civilization and man. And what we pointed out is that if you look until here, the story of the history of mankind is really a series of disasters. Right? Adam and Eve eat from the fruit and mess up. They have two children, Cain and Abel. Cain kills Abel. Then their descendants, the society, becomes corrupt, and God says they no longer are fulfilling their mission and sends the flood and starts over with Noah. And then 10 generations later, you have the Tower of Babel building a tower up to the heavens, and the rabbis say against the heavens to push God out, right? Man in technology, proving his greatness to the point where his ego takes over and God becomes irrelevant. So this is the scene that's set. It's one disaster after another after another. We talked last week, what does that say? What is Judaism saying about human nature? So maybe we'll answer that question as we bring in Abraham. So Abraham is introduced on page 53, and it basically tells us his background. There was Terah, he had Abraham and two brothers, and then he had a nephew. Abraham got married to Sarai, and by the way, it calls him Abram. He got married to Sarai, and then it tells us his father took his son Abram, this is verse 31, and his grandson Lot, and his daughter-in-law Sarai, and they left Ur of the Chasdim, going towards Canaan. They came as far as Haran and settled there, and Abram's father died. And here you have, so basically we're introduced to him, but this is really where the story of Abraham begins. And who would like to read chapter 12? Go ahead.
In English, right?
Yeah.
God said to Abram, "Go away from your land, from your birthplace, and from your father's house to the land that I will show you. I will make you into a great nation. I will bless you and make you great. You shall become a blessing. I will bless those who bless you, and he who curses you, I will curse. All the families of the earth will be blessed through you."
So all of a sudden, God starts talking to Abraham. And what's so puzzling is, who is this Abraham? Okay, we know he was born, his father, bro. He has a nephew, he got married, and then God is speaking to him, and not just speaking to him, but God, in essence, sends him on a mission. And the words in the Hebrew are lech lecha, which is some firm form of the saying, go, leave. So, what is he told to leave? His land, his birthplace, and his father's house, and go to the land I will show you. Now, the idea of textual study is we look at every word in the Torah, and we say, why does it say it this way? Why does it say it that way? So, let's ask questions about this verse, okay? So, first of all, the verb to go, lech lecha, is a double form. It's kind of saying, usually they translate it as, surely thou shalt go, which is kind of an emphasis. But there's more to it, so that's the first question. Why does it say go twice, which you cannot see in the English, but it's in the Hebrew. Then another question here, if anyone else has questions, please raise them. Where does he tell him to go?
To a place that I will show you.
What's peculiar about that?
That is not telling where to go.
Where do I go? Right. Abram, leave. So what do we learn from that? What's the first significant thing about the first sentence?
It's about the journey.
First of all, leaving where he is, and then it's about the journey. Very good.
Well, I also take away from that that there's to be certainty in the Creator, in God. You're telling me to go. Where am I going to go?
Okay.
You're going to show me. So, I got to trust.
It requires trust. Yeah. Very good. So it says that Abraham was tested with 10 tests in his life. And this is the first test. And there are many dimensions to this test. One is, he's told to go, but he doesn't know where he's going to go.
But I'll show you.
Another test, and he's got to trust. Another part of the test is, where is he told to leave? Leave your land, your birthplace, and your father's house. Now, what's peculiar about this is that if you left, what is the first thing you leave, you walk out of?
The house.
First you walk out of your house, then you walk out of your town, and then you leave your country. What is going on here?
Rivers.
It's said in the reverse order. Very peculiar. What's going on here? So it must be more than just a physical leaving. And Rabbi Jonathan Sacks points out something very interesting. He says that land, birthplace, and father's house denote several things. Land is your country, right? Every country has its culture, right? And its baggage.
It's material. It's like land. You can touch it.
Okay, that. But also, it has its culture. From Italy, you come to America. Totally different culture. People act differently. People's values are different. But they focus upon their priorities in life, right? It comes with a whole set of mores. So, then your birthplace implies your birth, what you're born with, your nature. Your father's house implies the home you were brought up. And each of those things, Rabbi Sacks says, so Marx says that people are a product of their society. Social forces are what define the person. He's saying, break out from your society, right? Spinoza said that man's, the physical world is what defines us. Man is his physical nature, his genome, right? And then it's all pre-programmed, according to modern science, right? If you can figure out the genes and figure out, you know, you'll figure out the person. And the father's house, Freud says, you are a product of your upbringing, right? Your old childhood experiences, how you were raised. That's what will define how you're going to be in the world. So in a sense, what God is telling Abraham is, break out from all of those things that you think are part of what define you, are beholden to you. Re-question yourself. And the rabbis tell us that, in fact, between this little... in this little blank between the lines, there was 80 years of Abraham's life that unfolded. What happened in that life? So he says Abraham was a spiritual seeker. Abraham, and this is in the rabbinic tradition, it tells us, Abraham, Maimonides says, at a young age started to question the world. Why are we here? What is life about? How did the sun and the stars get here? And by the age of 40, he had come to the conclusion that there is one God, and that God isn't just a physical God who created a physical world, but connecting to that God also implies other values, other ways that we need to lead our lives and how we treat others. We'll see Abraham's qualities. God defines as justice and righteousness, right, that he does. So that he pursues. So God is telling him, break away from those values. Now, the rabbis, another rabbinic teaching is that his father, in fact, they were living in ancient Iraq, and that was kind of the Tower of Babel, the ziggurats, right? They were polytheists. And Abraham's father owned an idol store. That was his business. So we have the Abraham and the cherry tree story, a la George Washington and the cherry tree, right? So one day, Abraham's father, Terach, leaves him in charge of the store. So Avram, you watch out after the store. I'll be back in a couple hours. You're old enough now, however old he was, 13, 15. Says, okay, fine. Comes back 2 hours later. The store is a mess. Idols are all shattered. Everything is destroyed. The father is distraught. where, you know, where, Abraham, I'm aware, what happened? I'm screaming. And he comes out. He says, what happened to all the idols? He said, and he left one idol, put the hammer in the hand of the idol. He said, he did it. And the father says, come on, what, you know, what are you making up stories? That can't do anything. And the neighbor tells to him, exactly. That idol can't do anything. What are we doing selling these idols? Pretending that these idols embody forces and gods that can do something. So he was the original iconoclast. He was the original questioner of his society's values. And just because everyone said, we worship these idols which represent forces of nature, Maimonides says that originally people were monotheists, right? Adam, Noah. But what happened was that people, in order to worship God, started, in a sense, worshiping, connecting to God's forces in nature as a way of honoring God. The analogy is like you would give honor to the president by honoring his secretary of state, right? So, and then people forgot to reconnect these forces back up to the one God. And that's how polytheism began. Connecting into the forces of nature and then worshipping them as a way to manipulate them, in a way to invoke them, in a way to channel them, not connected to the concept of one God. And the problem is when you do that, you disconnect your spirituality from morality and really permits anything you want to do. So he was the original iconoclast. He was the one to say, everyone is doing this. It doesn't mean they're right. And he was called Abraham the Ivri, the Hebrew. What does Ivri mean? So the rabbis say Ivri means from La'avor, to cross over. He came from the other side of the river. In other words, he was from different place, different from everyone else. And so this is the original free thinker who was willing to come to his conclusions, take a stand on what he believed, and hold steadfast to it. And in fact, the rabbis say that this polytheism was a state religion. Nimrod, famous emperor of ancient Babylon, was the ruler at the time, heard that Abraham had done this, called him in, said, you know, we've got to punish you unless you renounce what you did and you bow down to these gods. He refused. He was thrown into a fiery furnace. So that was one of their gods, was the god of fire. And Abraham said, I believe in my God and I don't bow to other gods. And he said, okay, let's see what your God can do for you now. Throws him in the furnace and Abraham is miraculously saved. So that's the first test, that Abraham was willing to put his life on the line for his beliefs. And now, the big question is, these are fascinating stories, inspiring stories, the original truth seeker, putting his life on the line, the iconoclast, willing to defy popular culture. Why doesn't the Torah tell us? Why do we just jump in when Abraham is at this point where God's saying, okay, now take your journey to the next step? So, Nachmanides says that the Torah starts from the place of Abraham's journey towards the light and towards God and towards actualizing the conclusions he's come to. It doesn't want to get bogged down in leaving all the negativity, breaking away from all the idolatry. So that's why it starts with this. And it leaves all the other backstory to the oral tradition. So Abraham sets out on this journey. Now, we're going to learn in a second, because it says, he went with all the souls that he had made. What does that mean? It means he had, not only did he have this belief in God, but he shared it with other people. So he had followers. He saw his mission not just to live this himself, but to bring other people to this belief. And We saw the elections, right? People are passionate about their beliefs and share them with others, right? Especially in the age of the internet now, you can, everyone can be have their soapbox on Facebook. So this is what Abraham did. Now, think about it. You live in downtown New York, right? Or London. You set up your soapbox on Hyde Park Corner. You got thousands of people walking by you every day. If you're in the getting the word out business, no better place to be than downtown Mesopotamia in the ancient world. And Abraham is told, leave all of this and go to this place I will show you. And which winds up being Canaan, which is a backwater, dusty dust bowl with a few Canaanites living there. How are you going to start a movement with less of an audience, not more? Doesn't make sense, right? But for some reason, Abraham's being told, no, to actualize yourself, you have to leave this place where you could theoretically be more successful. So that's another one of his tests. Logically, it didn't make sense. But God's saying, no, this is how you're fulfilling your divine mission. Why? So what we just saw is that Abraham's being told, you need to break away from certain things in your life that are holding you back. And in order to do that, you need to make a move. Sometimes it's a physical move. And in fact, the great spiritual masters, the Hasidic Rebbes, in the Zohar, Rabbi Shimon Bar Yochai, they would just set off on what they called gullus, self-imposed exile. And there are stories of great rabbis putting on an old coat, putting on a peasant's hat, and just leaving, just setting off. And I actually had one of my teachers, when he, before he was married, he has jokes about it, before he was married, he would do this. He would just, before, 1 year before Passover, he just got on a plane, went to California, felt like, this is where I need to go, had no idea where he was going to stay, how he would have Passover, whose Seder he would go to. And he would just set off. At the time, I was a rabbi in a synagogue in Long Island, and we had an agreement. He could come anytime. So sometimes, like 1 hour before Shabbat, he'd just show up. This is where I'm supposed to be. And people are on these journeys often, like Abraham. They feel like, you know, they kind of like go with, if you've ever traveled, you know, traveling can be very anxiety provoking. You know, tomorrow night I'm talking about 3 months I spent traveling across Africa. And when you're traveling, you don't, some of them, you don't, you know, that kind of traveling, you don't know where you're going to be sleep the next night, right? And it's all kind of like, and you kind of have, sometimes can just trust your instincts. Oh, like, this is a good place. Like, this makes sense. You just, it's not like rationally planned out. It's not like I've taken the map and the guidebooks. You're just kind of like, oh yeah, this is where I'll go with my next step. So, and that's being led by God. And that's part of the idea of the land I will show you. It wasn't a journey like, okay, I'm going to travel out, plan it out. It was a journey to leave behind the things that were holding him back from his society and even received from his family. And it was also a journey of, like Jesse said, trusting in God that the next step where he's supposed to go will present itself at the time. And this can be a metaphor for life. You know, sometimes we always want to know, we always want a plan, to know what the future is going to bring, how we're going to do it, how we're going to accomplish it. And life doesn't work like that. It doesn't work in such a linear way. And so when you're on a journey with God, okay, I'm here today. Where will I be tomorrow? We'll figure it out. But God's with me, and that was the land I will show you. The other thing is that when we do start to grow spiritually, it's hard to let go of those things that we, certain values of our family, certain values of our culture, it's hard to let go of them because we feel like that's me. And if I let go of them and grow beyond it, I'll be lost. Met with a guy today, and he comes from, his family's in real estate. He's in real estate, and he's kind of realizing like he's on this treadmill and running and traveling. It's a young guy still, and it's exciting. And it's, but he's kind of like, you know, where is all this leading me? And it was always assumed, you know, his family's in real estate. He's going to do real estate. Went to private prep schools and college, and it's kind of like has this career path. And now he's kind of like, well, where is this all going? And it's kind of scary because he's kind of questioning the things that were always just kind of given to him, and he just followed. And so, and it's scary, because when you're on a spiritual path, sometimes you're afraid, we're afraid we're going to lose ourselves. Like, where is this going to lead me? Right? So that's what Lech Lecha means. Literally means go to yourself. To find yourself, sometimes you have to leave behind certain things that maybe are part of your life, but you never chose. And they're part of your life because they're part of your culture, or they're part of your family's culture, or part of, you know. And it can be very scary. So that's why it's the land I will show you. Why don't we change? We don't change because we're afraid of the unknown. So the me that I know that maybe I'm not happy with, or that is unhappy, is better than the unknown me that is scary, because I don't know where that is. So we stay in with our old selves, and we don't change, because we're afraid of the unknown. And Abraham's being told, go to the land I will show you. I can't tell you where it is now, because, you know, that next three steps down the line will only come when you've done step number one and two. And how you do them will then determine step number three. And he's being told, Lech Lecha, go to yourself. If you set out on this journey, and if you're willing to explore the unknown, and to let go of certain things that maybe you're not beholden to, but are comfortable, then that's how you truly will find yourself, by making the conscious choice of where my life wants to go. So that's what Abraham was being told. He realized that there are parts of his culture that didn't work, but now God's saying, okay, so break away from it. Come to me. And through that, you'll find your true self. Why? Because your true self is deeper than than your association with your country, or even than your community, or even than even your family. So, so that's the journey that he's being challenged to set out on, and that's one of his tests. I'm scared. So we all go on different journeys. You know, sometimes journeys are physical journeys of traveling. Sometimes journeys are journeys of a relationship. Sometimes journeys are in our professional lives. And this is a model of, you know, trusting in God, following one's true heart, and being true to oneself, and that will bring us towards, more towards ourselves than all the things that we hold on to. Okay. I'll make you into a great nation. I will bless you and make you great, and you will be a blessing. So Abraham, God reassures him, says, if you do this, that's when the blessings will truly come. So what are each of these blessings? So Rashi points out each of these. So, and he says that when a person moves, when they move to a new place, so there are three things that become more difficult, right? So first of all, it becomes more difficult to have children, to raise a family, because he's traveling, he's in dangerous places, right? It becomes difficult to earn a livelihood, because you're uprooted, and you're becomes more difficult because no one knows you. You're an unknown, right? So he says, I'll make you a great nation, meaning you will have children, you'll be able to establish a family. I'll bless you with prosperity, and I'll make your name you great, meaning your reputation will continue to follow you. So he's saying all these things which you're afraid are going to be put in jeopardy by going on this journey, don't worry, I'll take care of them for you. And then he says, and you shall be a blessing. Let me do the next verse. I will bless those who bless you, and he who curses you, I will curse. And all the families of the earth will be blessed through you. So, it's very interesting. A lot of the evangelical Christians are extremely pro-Zionist. Pence is extremely pro-Zionist, and a lot of it comes from his Christian faith. And a lot of them base it upon this verse. It says that those who bless Abraham's descendants will be blessed, and those who go against them will be cursed. So they say, we want to be on God's good side, so we're going to get behind the Jewish people and behind the state of Israel. And there are some people who say, if you look, each of these times that Jews were kicked out of different countries, Jews were kicked out of Spain, what happened to the great Spanish Empire? It went down. Jews were kicked out of Western Europe, and actually, the Poles invited us in the 1600s. They wanted the Jews. They knew the Jews would be a blessing. They'd bring commerce, they'd bring education, they'd bring all these assets. So, and then, the final line, this line is, every time I read it, it blows me away. Because first of all, it's absurd that God would tell him this. And then if you think about the implications, it's even more absurd. So it says, all the families of the earth will be blessed through you. All the families of the earth. Now, 3,900 years ago, I don't know how many people are in the world. I don't know, you know. Tens of millions, hundreds of millions, who knows? But here is some, you know, principled young man being sent off to some backwater country, Canaan, who becomes a sheikh. He's got a few thousand followers. So we're going to see later he musters an army of 318 soldiers. So he's got an entourage, which Maimonides says did number in a few thousand maybe. But to say from that all the families of the earth will be blessed through you, so you say, well, maybe it's metaphorical, and it's... So if you think about it today, here we are, 3,900 years ago, and about 2.5 billion people in the world consider themselves to be the spiritual descendants of Abraham. All right? Christianity and Islam, and Judaism. So, what's the likelihood that 3,900 years later, 2.5 billion people follow Abraham's teachings? It's absurd, right? But yet, here it is, God promised him this. We only have another 2.5 billion to go. Okay. And paradoxically, these great numbers came about not through Judaism, his descendants, but through other spin-off religions, Christianity and Islam, right? But, I mean, here you see it. The words are here, and here we are 3,900 years later. And we're halfway there. So this is the point that we pointed out before, that each of those stories in the beginning of Genesis showed a disaster, okay? And last week we talked about this, how... So, Adam and Eve shirked off personal responsibility, right? When God says, why do you eat? To Adam, what did he say? Oh, that woman you gave me, she's the one who got me to do this. Right? God says, eat anything but this one fruit, and what does he do? That's the one thing he goes and does. So that's shirking off personal responsibility. Then you have Cain. What does Cain say after he kills his brother? Am I my brother's keeper? That's shirking off moral responsibility. I can do whatever I want to, this guy. He upset me. Right? Then you have the flood, which is, it said Noah was righteous in his generation. And that means maybe, considering how rotten everyone was, so he was okay. But he only saved himself. So people in that generation were throwing off collective responsibility, and they were... Noah even himself really did not accept upon himself collective responsibility, right? He didn't engage others and warn them and tell them to change. And finally, with the Tower of Babel, they threw off what Rabbi Sacks calls ontological responsibility. That's a responsibility towards God. We can build a tower. We can create. We don't need a creator. Man can do it all. If I can build a tower that's so tall, I can do anything. And who needs God? So what Rabbi Sacks points out is that Abraham's life is a response to each of these failings of the beginning of humanity, right? His journey, God telling him to set out on his journey, he takes upon himself personal responsibility, right? To continue his growth and his journey in his life. Then we're going to see that his brother-in-law, Lot, gets kidnapped. And what does he do? He puts his life on the line to save his brother. The exact opposite of what Cain did. Cain killed his brother. Abraham puts his life on the line for his brother-in-law. Then God's going to destroy the city of Sodom, the wicked city. And what does Abraham do? He stands up before God and said, God, you can't do this. Maybe there's some good people here. That's standing up for collective responsibility. He feels bought in to everyone else's fate and to stick up for them. And finally, and this we're going to see, these two stories we'll see next week, when he is willing to take an offer, bring his son as an offering, it's the ultimate ontological responsibility. He follows God even to the point of giving up that which is most precious to him. So Abraham rectified all the failings of the previous generations. And that's the point here, is that God promised Noah, I will no longer destroy the world. So, man does not fulfill his purpose. What is the purpose of man? It says man's created in God's image. And our purpose is to live that divine image. And we didn't. So, the generation of the flood, God said, man isn't fulfilling his purpose. He is not justified to be here. So he starts over again. So now he promised he won't get rid of man. He won't bring another flood. So he can't clean slate and start over, so he needs a different plan. What is that plan? That plan is rehab for the world, right? Instead of getting rid and starting over, he said, okay, we're going to turn the tide back. We've got to reverse the fall of man. How are we going to do that? Well, here's Abraham. He can start that process.
Leading by example.
Leading by example. Living those values that the people failed in. And then he'll have children, and he says, you will become a great nation. And we will form a nation who will live this example. And that's why I said the paradox, Jews were never supposed to proselytize. So how are you going to change the world? You live by example. And then you had spin-off religions who did proselytize, sometimes with the sword, and it gets messy. So that's not the ideal either, but the point is that this is the turning point. This is the hope for the future of man. And Abraham was told, you know, that he had a consciousness of that because he had already gathered disciples. But God tells him, yes, you are going to play a role in the history of humanity. And, you know, that blows me away. Just looking at that says something more is going on with this book than just a bunch of nice spiritual teachings, right? There must be a bigger plan, vision going on here. If this book says that this is what he's going to do, and we see that, you know, the impact it had on the rest of the history of humanity. So, you know, that's what Abraham is about. And Abraham, literally, what does it mean? Avram, elevated father. Nimrod, what did he do? Lered means to go down, to drag people down. So Nimrod was dragging people down paradoxically by building this tower up to the heavens. It said they wanted to make themselves a name. They wanted a reputation. They wanted honor. They wanted power. So he built up and brought people down. Abraham, who says, I am dust and ashes, I am nothing, it's humility, and was willing to leave his reputation behind, he is the elevated father. He's the one who really goes up because he's humble. Nimrod builds up and really he brings people down. Abraham is humble and that's what elevated father, he brings people up. It's paradoxical, it's counterintuitive, but that's the difference between a materialistic view of the world and a spiritual view of the world, right? Materialistic view of the world, the person who's got the biggest is the best, the most power, that's the real name, that's honor. And the spiritual view is no, the person who has the values and the quality of their soul, that ultimately will get the recognition. And it's a powerful message. And that's the turning point here. And this is why Abraham is the beginning of... The Zohar says, Avram, the elevated father, means the soul. Because Abraham listened to his soul. And we each have, meaning a elevated father who is a teacher. We each have within us a teacher, our divine soul, that leads us on our spiritual path. Right. Okay. Let's just read the next paragraph. Mark, you want to read?
Sure.
Getting
is it Abram?
Yeah. Verse 4.
Abram went as God had directed him, and Lot went with him. Abram was 75 years old when he left Haran. Abram took his wife Sarai, his nephew Lot, and all their belongings, as well as the people they had gathered. And they left, heading toward Canaan. When they came to Canaan, Abram traveled through the land as far as the area of Shechem, coming to the plain of Moreh. The Canaanites were then in the land.
Okay, so, and read one more verse.
God appeared to Abram and said, I will give this land to your offspring. Abram built an altar there to God who had appeared to him.
Okay, so 3 points I want to make. One is, there it says, they brought the top line, the people they had gathered. Literally, the Hebrew says, the people they had made, which is a very strange expression. What does it mean, people that they had made? So these were Abraham's spiritual disciples, and in effect, he had transformed their lives and their persona, like he had transformed himself. Right? So a person who grows spiritually, in a sense, remakes himself. Right? The second point is that he camped between the villages, not in the village. And that's the point we saw before, is that, you know, it's very hard to go against the host culture if your values are different. We get influenced by it. We get pulled at by it. So Abraham left, culture he knew, and stayed somewhat apart. And often, that's the Jew, you know, if you're trying to keep your values and not speak Lashon Hara, not gossip about people. And at work, every day in the break, everyone just gathers, you know, in by the coffee machine and starts talking about the other person, you know, on the other side of the office. You can't go hang out, right? If they go out and have drinks after work and they just, you know, start gossiping and saying things about people, it's not good to hang out there, right? You have to say, okay, not my scene. Can't do this. So often it means making choices of having to say, okay, you know, if you have a friend in your life and you feel they're not a good influence, sometimes to say, you know what, that isn't a good influence in my life. I've got to move. So Abraham stayed outside of the Canaanite cities. And then God promises him the land. So right after he promises him the land, it says there's a famine in the land. There's no food. What does he do? He has to leave. So here's another test. God says, go to the place I will show you. somehow he directs and he comes to this place. He said, this is your place, this is your land. And then what happens? There's no food. He can't stay there. Right? Good night. Thank you for coming. So, that's his next test. We're not going to read through it in detail, but he goes down to Egypt, puts Sarah in danger. She's taken by Pharaoh. He becomes sick, realizes that it might have to do with him taking this woman, and sends them out. And they go back to the land of Canaan. Now, the next story, and I think we'll end with this, is the story of Lot. Lot was Abraham's brother-in-law. So they're living in the land, they're shepherds, and Lot, their shepherds are fighting. Apparently there's not enough grazing room. So Abraham says, you know, let's not argue, let's not fight. He says to Lot, he says, let's see exactly. Right. He says, let's not have fighting between me and you, between my shepherds and yours. We're all brothers. All the land is before you. You can move on, and if you'd like, you can go to the left, I'll go to the right. If you want to go to the right, I'll go to the left. And as he's saying, you choose, you find where you want to go. So we see that his ways are peace. He says, if you want to grow the business and we're stepping on each other's toes, then by all means, do what you got to do. It's okay. But kind of the question is, what is your value here? Are you going to say, okay, we want the family to stay together, and so the business won't grow? Or, oh, I've got this great business opportunity, so I'm going to move to the other side of the country. The family won't be together. That's the price you pay. There was a very stark choice of career or family. And, you know, the culture we live in, there's no second thought, you know. You got a good degree, you went to good school, you got a great business opportunity. Sure, of course you got to go, right? But if you think about it, you know, what is important in life? Family, career, both have their value. When you have to choose between one or the other, it's not so simple. What are you giving up? So, Lot looked up and he saw the entire Jordan plain and that there was a lot of water there. It was a very prosperous area. Then it says it was like God's garden, like the Garden of Egypt. Now here already you have the warning. Okay, what is Egypt? Egypt was a very corrupt society. Abraham goes to his wife, they want to grab her because she's pretty. The pharaohs married their siblings. It was a very decadent society. And Lot saw that. So there was a lot of opportunity there. It's a rich area. And we're now at the bottom of 59. So Lot chose for himself the entire Jordan plain. He headed eastward and the two separated. Abraham lived in the land of Canaan, while Lot dwelt in the cities of the plain in Sodom. So Lot goes to Sodom, to this rotten place. Why? Good opportunity, right? That's what his priority, he's setting his priority. And what happens? So visitors come into the town, and apparently Lot had Sodom had an interesting custom, is that strangers were not allowed. No foreigners, certainly no one that had any needs, and they only looked after themselves. So he lived with the tradition of Abraham, which we're going to see next week, is someone walks by, you invite them into your tent. So some strangers come into the town, he says, you know, come into my house, but, you know, be discreet about it. So they come in, he tries to take care of them in the way of Abraham. So he's still trying to keep his values in this place, And the people of the town start come to his door and start tumulting, right? And say, give us these people. Because it was illegal to bring guests, bring strangers. And why? So you're afraid, if you're nice to them, more people are going to come. They'll hear about it. And then you'll be overwhelmed. So Lot stands up to them and refuses. Where is it? Let me find it here. Let me just finish. So what happens is that Lot sticks up for his guests. And so what we're seeing is that Lot tries to keep his values, yet at the same time, those values weren't strong enough to say, I'm going to stay with my uncle Abraham and keep the family close. So next week we'll see, you know, the implications of this ambivalence. And really, in a sense, you know, Lot is all of us, right? Abraham was a tzaddik in Judaism. A tzaddik is someone who keeps his spiritual goals in the forefront, and everything in his life is directed towards those spiritual goals. The Beinoni, the person who's the average person, is pulled in different ways, right? He wants to be successful, yet he still wants to be righteous. He'll compromise. Okay, I've got to go to this place. Maybe it's not the best place to be, but I'll stick up for who I am. I'll try to keep my integrity. I know I'm not so strong, but I'll try anyway. And we're going to see that, you know, it's very difficult. He's ambivalent. He has conflicting values. He tries to juggle them, sometimes not so successfully. And Lot is a very interesting personality, because Abraham is the ideal, which we need and we should all strive for, but Lot is kind of a living example of people with our conflicts and our inner weaknesses and our ambivalence and our wanting to be good yet also being attracted to the material and trying to balance the two. So in a sense, he's a very real figure. So, and I think the two are really, so the question is, when Abraham says, okay, you know, if we have to separate, we can separate. Right after they separate, God comes to Abraham and he reiterates the promise to him. Not just that I will give you this land, but you will have children and they will inherit the land. And you have to wonder whether, in a sense, before Lot was holding him back. And now that Lot had left, Abraham really will be able to kind of take off and actualize his destiny. And you wonder whether Abraham was kind of saying to Lot, are you with me or not? And if you're not, it's okay, you can move on. So even within his own family, he was kind of, and he wouldn't kick him out, but he kind of said to him, you have a decision to make here. So that's the saga of Abraham. And we will continue with it next week's Parsha. Any questions?
I have a question.
Yeah.
When God says, I will bless you and make you great, I will bless those who bless you, and he who curses you, I will curse. Isn't that way like providing him some reassurance, even going to the unknown? Like, is there a sense of relief for him?
Well, it's a sense of being protected, yeah. And we said all these promises are kind of the things that you're going to lose, don't worry, you'll make them up. They'll be there for you.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. I mean, the question is,
it's kind of saying, like, things will be all right in the end.
Yeah, yeah.
And if it's not all right, it's not the end, or something like that.
Well, saying it'll be all right, like, and, you know, you'll be protected. Yeah, ultimately. Saying that. The question is, you know, what if he wouldn't get those promises? Like, what if he'd really feel like I'm making sacrifices and I'm not going to get something in return for them? So that's the story of Isaac, where he was asked to kind of take steps which were losing the thing that was precious to him and not getting promises in return. So that'll be at a later stage. Yeah. But yeah, we believe if we connect ourselves to a godly path, then God will give us blessings. Doesn't mean that connect myself to religiosity and I'll get rich. The blessings could be spiritual blessings, not material blessings, you know. So. Okay.
Being rich isn't always a blessing.
That too. Yeah. Like people who are very wealthy, like, people are friendly with them and they're always asking themselves, why are they being friendly with me? Because of who I am or because of what I have? And, yeah, think about that, right?